seated, please. Court is ready to hear argument in 10-1028 P&S Storage versus Anna Rivera.
Court, Mr. Oliver will present argument for the petitioners. The petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Court, in this default judgment case, it's undisputed that service was improper. And when there's improper service, there is no jurisdiction of the person. And when there is no jurisdiction of the person, judgment it's had is void. Our view is that a void judgment cannot become unvoid, cannot come into being if it was never a good judgment to begin with.
How can you say that the notice that was provided to the registered agent was not imputed to you?
Assuming that the notice given to the registered agent was, in fact, the notice here, I think, let me go back. First of all, yes, they were our registered agent. Our dispute is whether or not the notice and the return of service was good or not. The idea being, of course, that because it was not, and because a person has no obligation to act unless the service was proper, and even though these elements of failure to follow strictly the rules as they apply to return of service were perhaps considered technical, the rules require that they be strictly enforced.
But isn't there a distinction between improper service that results in a denial of due process because someone really does not know about what's going on, and defects of the kind that are involved in this situation?
Perhaps the court is getting to the question of whether or not actual notice somehow cures technical defects.
Not just actual notice, or actually just no service, or service of the wrong person, or whatever.
Well, perhaps the issue is one of whether or not Dispenza decided things rightly. Our position is, if these rules, which were not mere formalities, not merely things for bureaucrats to do, but are strictly prima facie evidence of proper service, if they're not properly followed, then there is no notice. If there is no proper notice, there is no jurisdiction. And no matter what the person knows, whether they know of it or not, they have no duty to act. And that has been the law of both the United States Supreme Court and the state of Texas for a very long time. And so our view becomes that because there was none, we had no obligation to act. And so the question now becomes, as I perceive these cases, as to whether or not the court can look to the record as it stands and see that there was improper service, or whether or not it must turn a blind eye to what is clearly in the record, and that is a handful of defects that
prove. Did the improper service lead to a complete lack of notice, going to the question of whether it is a void or voidable judgment and whether you can attack it directly or collaterally?
I would say that it was, in the technical sense. Again, the issue of whether or not we ever came to know of this, we did not, factually. That's pretty clear from the record that was developed. But yes, our position is, even if these are technical issues, we did not get notice as the law understands notice to be, and therefore no duty.
Did you have a registered agent at the time?
We did indeed.
And what was the function of your registered agent?
To accept service, a process on our behalf.
Did they accept service for you in this case?
They say that they did.
Okay. And so, in any other case, is service on them, service on you, so to speak?
Indeed.
All right. But not here?
But not here, because it was improper.
Because of technical deficiencies.
Because of technical deficiencies. But, of course, the technical issue here, which is my second point, is whether or not the court is, again, or courts are, I should say, to turn a blind eye to the record merely because we have this residual limitations statute now, which didn't exist, say, back when McEwen was decided in 1961, and we make some sort of distinction, some sort of artificial distinction, where we don't look to the record itself and see if indeed there were these defects, because they are. And that takes us, in the first instance, I think, to the Alfonso case. Alfonso was, as we know, a circumstance where the court looked to the record and found that there was no subject matter jurisdiction. That leaves an issue of whether or not there was some personal jurisdictional defect that the court could also look to. And I would argue, what indeed could there be distinction-wise that would make any sense? Because Austin and Pence School District and all the cases that have cited it have always had the same sentence. If you don't have jurisdiction of the person, of the property, or of the subject, then you don't have jurisdiction.
Well, didn't Alfonso have to do with a child custody matter?
It did indeed.
And that really, subject matter jurisdiction cannot be waived. But it had to do with the fact that that was deciding custody, right?
Indeed.
Which is really a little different aspect, right?
Well, it was also the procedural, the service defects here. I mean, there has to be some waiver issue involved. Otherwise, it seems to me that you would have a lot of default judgments out there that are void, such being set aside forever. And that can't be the rule. It has to come at some constitutional level, due process level, it seems to me, before it would become a void judgment.
If I perceive the question rightly, it seems to be a policy sort of a question. That is, are we opening Pandora's box by doing this particular thing? And I would argue that we do not, because upon who falls the risk? It's the person who comes back and says, hey, we never got proper service. It's the risk to them that over time the record is lost or destroyed and nothing remains but the judgment.
Here, but it does have the potential to invalidate a lot of judgments that have gathered a lot of dust over the years.
Well, potential perhaps, but let's take some of the cases that talk about these rules. It's very simple to get somebody served. And as the cases say, it's very simple to correct defects in service once that's done. So if we have an issue of whether or not there are a lot of them, I would argue, gosh, there are hundreds and hundreds of these things done every day and they're done right. The number that are done wrong seems to be very slim. And how many circumstances do we have in which a decade or decades later, someone comes forward and says, I have here a judgment no one has seen of, no one has acted upon, no one has attempted to execute upon, and here I have it, and we would not, under those circumstances, look at the record. And when it shows that there is no personal service, and no personal service resulting in a void judgment,
those few, however few they may be, there can be no finality to later attack, under your theory.
No finality. Well, there would certainly be finality if you were to look to the record and see that it was void. That would finalize the matter.
No, because it's subject to attack at any time. I mean, that's the issue. That if we don't make a distinction, and if you look at the Peralta case, I mean, that case said that when personal jurisdictional deficiencies are such that the party subject to the judgment is without notice at a meaningful time and in a meaningful manner to be given an opportunity to be heard, that's what they're talking about. That's what violates due process, not just mere technical defects. And if we hold that technical defects that do not give rise to a due process violation are going to subject these judgments to attack, not direct attack, collateral attacks, then we really are going far beyond, it seems to me, what we're directed to do by the case law out there.
If we look at Peralta, then we look at, say, Ross versus National Center for the Disabled, we see case after case saying that a party not properly served has no duty to act. So again, if there's some issue about whether we should do something or not, there's no duty for them to go further, so that these, while we may call them technical defects, they're absolute defects, it seems to me. Now back to your issue about whether or not we open again, as I perceive it, some sort of Pandora's box, I don't see the problem. How often does this come up when someone comes up with a judgment in a case that has already been litigated fully and decided on its merits someplace else and then sits on it? This issue seems to me very similar to that of Alfonso versus Skadden, where again you have a circumstance where somebody waited 4 years and 3 days and then deciding, probably, almost certainly, I would suspect, that because if you don't look beyond the judgment itself, some injustice would be done. And that's, of course, the problem with all default judgments. That's why the law abhors default judgments, because almost certainly when the parties have been deprived of their opportunity to put on their evidence and argue the law, injustice is likely to have been done.
Well, you could have designated another agent for service, or but let me take you to the whether there are any fact issues that would toll the limitations here. At the time the state suit was filed, counsel was aware of opposing counsel's name and address, and the default judgment rules require that you serve the party at their last known address. Rather than doing that, Mr. Tamez chose to serve through the registered agent. Does that raise any issues with respect to extrinsic fraud that might toll the limitations on the bill of review, for example?
That was to be our second point, which is to say that despite the residual statute of limitations, in the case of extrinsic fraud, it's tolled in essence. And here our evidence of extrinsic fraud is as follows. There was a failure to speak. An omission, and there were at least two of them. First of all, the attorney who took this default judgment had just 4 days before he filed this second one finished litigating this very matter in which depositions were taken, and it went to a magistrate, and then he submitted more information, and they had more arguments, and he had a final judgment. And he knew our local counsel. He knew his name. He obviously had. He'd sat across from him at deposition and had been at the hearings with him, and yet he did not give him notice. And furthermore, and we can only assume this, I'm afraid, and that is that the trial court who rendered this default judgment must not have heard that there was this other judgment already out there.
But doesn't extrinsic fraud really deal with the denial of allowing the other party an opportunity to fully litigate all the rights or defenses? I mean, that's really how the case is defined extrinsic fraud, and it seems to me that on these facts that's not what we have.
Well, certainly the testimony has developed here. If we look back, we have to remember that we waived the attorney-client privilege. We allowed them to come depose our in-house counsel, our local counsel, the secretary paralegal to look through our documents in our database. We didn't have this. And what we do know from our local counsel is he said he's going to look and see if this case was ever to be refiled. And we followed up with him months after this happened, and he said, I've heard nothing further about it. So our position would be, had Mr. Tamez told our local counsel that he was about to take a default judgment, and he had indeed taken one, we wouldn't be here today.
Well, the issue is under Rule 239A, he had to send notice to the last known address. Again, is there something in the record that supports that, in fact, the last known address was known and he purposely didn't do that but went instead first served and delivered notice to the registered agent?
Well, certainly in that regard, because he had contacted our risk loss people at the home office to give a demand. Even before he filed the first lawsuit, he knew where we were, he knew who we were, he knew our in-house counsel, he knew our local counsel, and he gave them no notice of either. Now, again, it seems to me that this case sort of turns on this distinction in large part between whether or not we can look beyond the record in a personal jurisdiction matter. And I want to come back to your question because it's a profound, and that is, do we indeed open some sort of Pandora's box if we allow people to go back and look? But I wonder about this circumstance, having started practicing law in Beaumont, Texas, and back at the time there was sort of a cottage industry of people who would file these claims to be heirs of the Spindletop land, and these things were litigated over and over and finally done away with. And I can certainly understand the court's interest in the finality of judgments. But again, our argument would be here is the risk is all on us that this is lost, because we agree there ought to be a presumption in favor of this. These old judgments are good. But if we can simply turn the page and see the rest of the record and see that they're not good, that ought to be enough. And I would also argue, if you look back at the oldest cases here in Texas, they used the language, the record, somewhere along the way. This idea that we're going to look only to the face of the judgment got replaced with no real explanation, replace the idea of look at the entire record. And I see no distinction between subject and personal. In fact, the idea that a judgment, for example, that is bad because the justice of the peace exceeded his or her jurisdictional limit, that ought to be perhaps less offensive than a judgment being rendered against someone over whom personal jurisdiction was never obtained. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondents.
The court, Mr. Ciano will present argument for the respondents.
Please, the court. One of the things, based on the questions I've heard, that is incredibly important in this case and why I took the deposition of the organizational representative for the store in this case, who I asked to be produced in the case to speak to areas of their contentions concerning what they were claiming as their defenses, as to what knowledge they had, et cetera. I went and took his deposition, Mr. Schlonsky. The record's filled with the references to him. Schlonsky not only is the one that is alleged to have received the notice from the agent for service of process, but he's the one that was taken. And I asked him the question that the court posed a moment ago about this issue about the agent for service of process and what his capacity was. The facts in this case are undisputed, and let me make this very clear, they are undisputed. Schlonsky said not only was the agent for service of process the person that they wanted service to go to, the evidence in this case is undisputed that Schlonsky was the guy they wanted the notice of judgment to go to. Let me say that again. He testified as part of his testimony as the organizational representative, he wanted the notice of judgment to go to him. And he said because if it went to the office and it got lost in the office, that was a problem. He didn't want to go to the individual stores or principal places. He wanted it to go to the people that would get it to them. And what's the evidence in this case? The evidence is they got it. They got it.
Does that matter?
It does matter.
Why? Because I thought you would concede that if a passerby just said, oh, I was down at the courthouse, I heard you got sued, and I actually, I brought you a copy of the pleadings. That wouldn't matter, would it?
Well, let me answer it this way. It has to matter, and let me tell you why it has to. We have set up, in the old days, in the 1800s, before the Special Practices Act, you know, history, the phrase, if you don't remember it, it's bound to repeat it. Special Practice Act was the beginning of the rules of procedure. They applied to some of the counties, not all of the counties. By 1939, Bexar County was had the rules. By 40s, the district courts, all the district courts had it. By the 60s, and it's a critical time period, 61, 62, is when all the courts were subject to it.
Well, let me bring you back to the question, though. The question is, if somebody were just walking through the courthouse and heard that PNS had got sued and got a copy of the pleadings and it sent it to them, just FYI, you couldn't sustain a default judgment on that, could you?
Well, it depends when. I disagree, and here's why.
So if the judge...
Actual notice is an important...
Let me ask you.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
So that if the judge rendered a default judgment on that kind of notice, it could not later be set aside.
Notice where someone called him out in the courthouse?
Yeah.
I think the issue of actual notice is a critical component under the rules of civil procedure, and let me explain why.
I just want the answer to my question, then you can explain all you want.
I'm sorry. I think actual notice of any kind is adequate to start and trigger the time period expressly stated under 329 of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure.
All right.
So in other words, what I'm trying to convey is the argument of, and let me kind of address it in the context of Justice Calvert in 1961 authored the opinion involving McEwen, and he articulated the difference between void and voidable. He described how the cases involving a technical defect involving service were going to fall into the second category, where if there were recitals in the record, if there were statements in the record that identified jurisdictional facts, you couldn't go below the face of the judgment. after a certain period of time. And here's the balance, because that's what the rules did. Because otherwise, here's what happens. If the rule is now going to be the following, that once a defendant receives actual notice of a judgment through the court process, undisputed for the person they wanted to receive it, and they can then say, I'm not going to file a motion for new trial. There's no burden for them to meet the Craddock factors. They go to the next day, the Hagedorn factors of the bill of review. They don't have to meet those. They're better off. They're literally better off to say, I didn't see it, because they don't have an obligation to do anything. And Rule 329 says just the opposite. It says if the party learns, it says if the lawyer learns, and then there's a third item. If you look at the rule, it says actual notice. And that's the triggering event for motion for new trial. And in the 30-day period, there's no dispute. Had they simply acted on what the actual notice was in the presence of their organizational representative who was designated the agent for service of process, they could have come in and filed a motion for new trial, and the rules and the procedures and the burdens of proof were way on their side. There's a no presumption of a judgment. All the issues and the technical I-dotting and T-crossing a motion for new trial would have been granted, more likely than not. We'd have gotten our fees. They'd have been appeared before the court, and we'd have started over. But then 30 days went by, and then 6 months, and then the rules narrow, and the rules and the evidence that's allowed to be offered changes, and it's got to be on the face of the record. And then when it gets to 4 years, that's 6 months to 4 years, again, additional requirements. And what they keep missing, and what the trial court and the courts of appeals emphasized in this case, is once you received actual notice under the undisputed evidence from the person you said should get the notice, that point triggered the obligation to file a bill of review. And then 5 years went by. The record, you know, Judge Morales didn't just sign a default judgment. Go back to it. He interlined. He reviewed evidence involving unliquidated damage. You can see by the numbers that he wrote and how he interlined the amount. He just didn't take whatever the plaintiff's lawyer offered in evidence in the case.
Did you comply with Rule 239A? To send notice to the last known address.
The answer is absolutely they did not comply with a rule to send it to the principal office. In Layton, the Texas Supreme Court case says that it is not, as a matter of law, extrinsic fraud. Layton. All right, and here's why. Because what their contention is that this lawyer sat down, thought about how it is that he could not give notice and hide it from him. Who better, as evidence of what the evidence is, who better could he have given notice to than the person designated by them to receive the notice? And it's not extrinsic fraud.
The lawyer would be better?
I'm sorry?
The lawyer, the defendant's lawyer would be better?
I'm saying not the defendant's designated person that they said should receive it.
Right, but you said who would be better, and in our legal profession, usually it is a telephone call or a letter to opposing counsel. That's typically how you communicate. If you want to get the notice directly, the best way possible, you call the lawyer or you send a notice.
I think he could have called up and said, hey, I'm not going to take a default against you. I just want you to know, file an answer. He could have done that. Then someone else would come back later and say he's got a legal obligation to zealously represent his client within the bounds of the law. Right? And his obligation is to present his case. If they don't raise the statute of limitations, am I supposed to call up the defense lawyer and say, hey, by the way, you can win on the statute of limitations?
Didn't the lawyer's creed take care of that, though?
And I don't understand the question, Your Honor.
Well, the lawyer's creed says that you won't, if you know who's representing the other side, you won't take a default without letting them know about it, doesn't it? And the lawyer does have an ethical obligation, clearly, to his or her client. And then we have the lawyer's creed, though, that steps in and says, well, you've got another obligation above and beyond that. And so, but doesn't the lawyer's creed specifically address the issue?
I think the Texas lawyer's creed addresses the issue in a couple of ways. In this, first, the preamble said it's not to ingrain and engender and add additional requirements on the rules of procedure. And there's a specific provision that says we're not going to have that be the basis of a new set of rules. The legislature entered and set up a procedure on how to attack judgments by direct attack. They said once there's actual notice, there's a set of time periods that happen. And the lawyer...
I'm not arguing with that. I'm just addressing your question. The Chief Justice asked, who else could you notify? And the answer you say is, the lawyer has an ethical obligation, yes. But we do have, as a profession, we do have, and we have alleviated some of that in a particular manner for default judgments. I think that's all I was going
for.
I'm not arguing with the legislature or our rules or anything else.
And two cases that have addressed that exact issue, the Houston Court and Dallas Court, have both said that does not add an additional requirement for direct attacks. So what's the evidence of... Let me answer it this way.
Would you agree that we have typically examined very closely service in regard to default judgments?
Yes.
And so you have someone who took over $1 million default judgment, and with the knowledge, as most lawyers who've been to the courthouse very infrequently, even much less frequently, know, Texas courts have typically examined those very closely. And it would seem as though, we're talking about the other side, but it seems as though that if you want to keep $1 million-plus default judgment, you would go look and make sure you had your I's dotted and your T's crossed in order to maintain that.
I think certainly the better practice is to look at those issues. And the dilemma with that is if you don't, at the motion from new trial stage, that judgment's likely to get set aside. At the bill of review stage, if there's not a recital in the judgment, it's likely to get aside. But when a district judge puts a recital in his judgment and sets out the jurisdictional facts, and the record that involves that discussion is gone, it's no longer in existence because they waited 9 years before looking for it. Now the issue is, have they brought in evidence that the trial judge didn't hear other evidence involving those issues at the time of what the service was, or other evidence, and they can't offer any. So the dilemma is, and his comment about there's no real disaster, that was his thought. I can't think of anything real bad that would happen. Let me talk to you about something called the Eagle Ford Shale. Maybe you all have heard about it. It's also called the Barnett Shale up in the north. There's a little play going on south of town. Lots of stuff's going on currently.
A lot of earthquakes.
Yeah, a lot of earthquakes. We'll have a battle about the water and everything else next. But think of the disaster that this has caused, that this would cause. Really, think about it. Because if the court rules today that you can attack a judgment 9 years, 20 years, 30 years for a technical I dot T cross when there's a jurisdictional statement on the face of the record and no evidence offered to contradict what happened in the underlying trial court because the record is no longer there, Dan's going to open up a new business called dansdefaults.com LLC. And I'm going to look through and I'm going to contact every one of the courts in that area where they're oil and gas rights, and I'm going to look for any evidence, not on the face of the record. I'm going to go down to the green cards and see if they put the year 2010 on it instead of just put the day and the month.
Dan, would you be successful in your business if there was fraud in the procurement of those judgments?
The answer would be absolutely not if there was fraud procured in getting the judgment.
Is it fraud if you represent to a judge that you have a right to proceed in a lawsuit when you knew or should have known that it had been dismissed with prejudice in the federal court?
Good question. And the answer is, the lawyer in this case had an absolute right to say it was not dismissed with prejudice. He had, in fact...
Would the motion for summary judgment requested that the relief be with prejudice?
Say it again, I didn't understand.
The motion for summary judgment in the federal court, okay, went back many, many years ago. They asked that it be dismissed with prejudice.
Yes.
And in fact, in 2009, the federal court went back and amended an order and indicated that it should have been with prejudice. Did Mr. Tamez perpetrate a fraud on that court when it took a default judgment with the knowledge that it should have been with prejudice? Yes or no?
And the answer is no. And I answer that by this letter, which is part of the record. It's the lawyer for PNS who said, and it's part of the trial court record, he said that's what he thought it meant. He told them, that is, Mr. Carroll said, the judge is thinking Ms. Rivera may well elect to get a different attorney and will refile the claim. And they said, you heard it today, thank God on the record, He said, we expected our lawyer to monitor that. First time it's been said. All right? They expected their lawyer, Carol LaManna, and maybe that's what round two and three is in this case. The lawsuits against the lawyers or against the agent for service of process for not really giving us the notice. But this isn't going to end here, believe me. So the answer, Your Honor, is the case was understood by everybody to be without prejudice. I took the depositions, Your Honor, of Mr. Schlonsky. I took the deposition of Mr. White, which are the lawyers. They told me in the deposition, it's a summary judgment evidence, the way the record reads, yeah, you can refile it.
Is there any fraud in filing a certificate of last known address that says that you complied when you, in fact, sent it to another address, not the last known address?
No, Layton says that is not extrinsic fraud. There's already a ruling on that, and it can't be, because think of it, he is telling them, how can it be fraud to tell them that there is a judgment? That fraud would be to not tell them, to go in before the notice got over there and the letter's over in the mailbox, and you take it out of the mailbox and rip it up so they don't get it. That's the kind of extrinsic fraud that would give rise to that basis under failing to give notice, or in the other circumstance, never giving notice. And that's the difference in this case and why the circumstances of the way this case was tried and why the evidence was presented the way it was and why the court was right in granting a motion for summary judgment under the facts presented in the unique circumstances of this case. Every court that has looked at this issue involving void or voidable, every court that has addressed it, even post-Skadden, where it involves personal service of issues, personal jurisdiction issues, has said that those issues can be waived, and after the time ticks away, those rights to attack a judgment are gone.
Is this Layton case that you keep referring to, is that cited in your brief?
Yes.
Is that L-A-Y-T-O-N?
Yes.
And I think you said it was a Texas Supreme Court case? It's out of Corpus Christi.
Corpus Christi.
In 2000.
That's correct. But
the Texas Supreme Court has not spoken on that.
They have not said that 329 notice to a person that's supposed to get the notice according to the defendant is extrinsic fraud, and it should not be. If the lawyer was trying to conceal the existence of the judgment fraudulently, he would never have given the notice, not give the notice to someone that has. So to conclude, unless the court has additional questions in this case, this case will cause unintended consequences. It will allow persons to go back and look at administrations and probate proceedings in South Texas. It'll allow people to look at district court rulings involving trespass to try title. It'll allow all of us to go back and pull out those old records and disregard recitals and look to see if there's a Greek car and technical error. And the court and the rules of a procedure in the legislature have struck a balance. They say once it gets to that time period of 4 years, you lose the right to assert a bill of review. Absent extrinsic fraud, and then extrinsic fraud only tolls it, not for another 5 years, till you knew or should have known. And they actually knew. And that's the difference in this case and why the Court of Appeals opinion, in my opinion, was properly written. In my opinion, the court should find that the petition was improvidently granted, or if it wants to write on the subject because it's got nothing else to do, then the court can go back and write and discuss all of these issues, because I think candidly that the Fourth Court of Appeals decision was accurate.
If the court's got nothing better to do?
I'm being sarcastic. I mean, I apologize if you didn't understand it that way, and I apologize. What I mean by that, Your Honor, is that there's no reason to create an ambiguity in the law and create an issue about something where the Dallas court and the Houston court have already addressed this, the San Antonio court has addressed it, and they're soundly commenting about what the rule should be and has been properly decided. Thank you.
Court will hear rebuttal.
To address one of the questions, we don't know what Oscar Tamez thought about all this. He evaded service repeatedly. When he was finally served, it was videotaped. He jumped in his car and fled.
did not appear at his deposition, and the certificate of non-appearance was taken. We only know what he didn't say. We don't know what he did. With regard to this question about McEwen, on which Rivera relies, I think it's important to recall that this was written well before Peralta, which obviously in a case of no service, as we contend, means that these typical bill of review sorts of 1, 2, 3 meritorious defense prevented from acting, wasn't negligent in pursuing, get obviated in such a circumstance. But I think equally important to recall is that when McEwen was written, there was not this 4-year residual statute of limitations. If you look at the very end of the opinion, the justice goes through and says, well, this is not going to work all of these worried about injustices because, well, someone should be diligent and someone should have a meritorious defense. Those were obviated again by Peralta. But also goes on to say, and of course you always have your bill of review to come back. If there's a void judgment, if you haven't done any of these naughty things, you can come back and do this. Well, the problem here is with this 4-year limitation period stuck in between, it's given incentives just like those discussed in Browning versus Prostock for those most devious to find a way to get something done and then run out the clock. And so again, when you see in Alfonso someone waiting 4 years and 3 days, or in this case, 4 years and in a few months before he attempted to abstract the judgment, we know what's going on, and that is somebody's trying to run out the clock. And they're trying to run out the clock. Why? Because if that clock didn't run out, they have to know. Again, we don't know what Oscar Tamez was thinking, but he had to have known.
You know, we frequently address limitations questions and the discovery rule and so forth, and there's the constructive notice issue, you know, related to, well, that was the record was on file. It was a recorded document. You can't say that you didn't know because it was there. In the same courthouse where this lawsuit was pending, why wouldn't the same analogy or rule apply with respect to the fact that the lawsuit was there? You may not have known it was there, but given the question related to the without prejudice order out of the federal court, why wouldn't there be some duty to inquire?
Well, I think the answer is twofold. First of all, I don't think there isn't anything I can find that puts a duty on a lawyer to go hunt courthouse to courthouse, because he ought to be able to rely on a couple of things. First, before a default judgment is taken against him, that somebody's going to tell him if he knows exactly who they are, which was the circumstance in this case. More likely than not, that it's not even going to happen because we've already litigated the case and lost. And finally, the issue becomes, if there's no proper service, there's no duty to act at all. And again, our point becomes, there is no jurisdiction ex nihilo. It can't come from nothing. It can't be the case. It's simply by the passage of time, jurisdiction that never was comes into being.
Well, let's assume. Go ahead.
But it seems as though to criticize a lawyer for waiting 4 years, if that's in fact the law, before you abstract, does not seem to be much evidence of external fraud. All the lawyer is doing is representing his or her client, letting the judgment, I mean, you know, just to make sure. It seems like that's good representation. Unless there's some kind of, you say, defect in service up front.
Well, and of course, the courts have always given strict scrutiny to default judgments because, as I said before, justice is very rarely worked in those circumstances.
Waiting 4 years doesn't seem to be evidence to me of extensive fraud just because the lawyer did that.
I'm not asserting that it was, and I apologize if it came across that way. Instead, I'm simply saying that at the time of McEwen, if you look at the way it was written, at least to me, it clearly appears that you had a lot of time to do this. And so McEwen is easily distinguished because, in that case, Texaco was told at the very end, go file your bill of review. Don't worry about this. Well, they didn't say don't worry about this, but you are without prejudice to go file your bill of review because they had lots of time then that we don't have now. Unless there are further questions.
What is your response to the argument that, let's say, there was extrinsic fraud, but then they, but that only tolls things until they had until they knew or should have known what's going on. What's your response to that?
See if I understand the question correctly, because my first response would be, again, come back to the position Benoyer versus Neff, that without proper service, you're under no duty to act. And I would assume that that no duty to act extends to every sort of circumstance in which it would arise. But we knew nothing more about this after 4 years than after 5 or 6 or 7. It wasn't until they attempted to execute on this 9 years after that we had knowledge.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.